Part of being involved in the art world is the constant learning, which is why it's one reason why it's such an amazing sector to be involved in. It's always challenging. It's always, you're always adding to the knowledge that you have and always questioning the knowledge you've acquired.
This is Art Carter, an inside look at the businesses that make the art world work and the stories behind the people that shape them. Today we are joined by Tanya Barson, Curatorial Senior Director at House & Worth, and previous to her role with the gallery, she enjoyed 25 years as a museum curator, including her role as Chief Curator at MACBA Barcelona, and prior to this, various curatorial roles at Tate Modern, Tate Liverpool and Tate Milbank.
Thank you for joining us. I wanted to start off just understanding how you got into the art world, whether it was sort of a long-term aspiration or in the family, how you sort of started your passion.
It was, I guess, a childhood aspiration, obsession. I mean, I was always creative from a really early age. I was always drawing or painting or making things. And I think that that was always how I was happiest. And then, you know, I always did well at school in art, in contrast to most other subjects. That's a terrible thing to say.
No, don't worry. It's a recurring theme in a lot of people we speak to.
It literally, I mean, I wasn't terrible at other things. But the only thing I was really any good at was art. And I loved doing art whenever, in all of my free time, as much as I possibly could. That's what, from a really early age.
Were your family quite artistic? No.
I mean, not. I come from a very ordinary family in many respects, in terms of, my mother was a nurse and a housewife, and my father was an accountant. My mother made clothes. But the older I got, the more extraordinary a mind I discovered she had. And she later went to university as a mature student and studied classical civilization with philosophy. So somehow there was, you know, a kind of intellectual interest within the household, but it wasn't anything that they did professionally.
Yeah, you didn't spend your childhood in museums being...
No, in fact, I mean, I loved going to museums as a child, but mostly it was being taken by school, and I loved them. I absolutely loved museums. Whenever there was a trip to a museum, I would be like beside myself.
Your school sounds great. We ended up going to like Bracknell to count shoppers at my school.
Well, you know, wherever it was that they took us, I mean, we went umpteen times. I grew up in Hertfordshire, so we went umpteen times to Tring Museum, and I loved it, you know, and I would love, not that it wasn't that often. And then later when I was in my secondary school, my art teacher took us often to exhibitions. And he was probably, you know, the one special teacher that everyone has, you know, that they always remember. That was probably the biggest early influence on me, was my art teacher, who was called Alan Cater. And he had studied at the Royal Academy and would take us to exhibitions, often at the Royal Academy, but also the Tate, other places. And so, you know, that was probably one of the most significant influences that sort of pushed me towards a profession in the arts.
And then you say when you were younger, obviously you were quite creative yourself. In terms of study, did you actually then move into training as an artist, or was it sort of art history? Where did you...
No, I mean, for the longest time, I thought I would go to art school. And then I think I had a sort of rethink when I was in my sixth form year and thought, no, I'm going to do art history and film studies and think about exposing myself to a really wide variety of ideas. And so that's where it turned towards. And I went to the University of Kent. I mean, the easy answer is that I studied art history at the University of Kent and then the Courtauld. But the Kent course was very interdisciplinary, and I think that was quite important. It showed me to look for ideas in a much broader spectrum of places. And so I did art history, but with film studies, theatre studies, theory, theory and history only, not practical, and some aspects of classics and of cultural studies and sociology. You know, so there were, I was able to take courses from different faculties, which meant I got a broader sense of, or a broader spectrum of ideas, or exposed to a broader spectrum of ideas, and sort of a broader possibility, set of possibilities as well.
Was that BA? So you were able to pick different
courses? Yeah. Yeah.
And then you did an MA at Courtauld.
Exactly, yes. Yes, which was much more rigorous. And I think I spent the entire time with imposter syndrome.
And was that art history as well, or was that then moving to curatorial?
That was art history, yeah. Yeah. I wasn't aware of any curatorial courses when I was studying. So that was art history. And quite rigorous art history. And I was, in a way, that was deliberate as well, to go towards something that was a much more classical, rigorous, academically minded art history, which I, you know, I'd done all this kind of exploration as an undergrad, but then I wanted to really understand the discipline of art history. Maybe that's a kind of interesting word, isn't it?
I see what you mean. That often tends to go the other way. You tend to have quite a disciplined initial introduction to a subject, and then as you progress, you're able to experiment perhaps more freely academically, I guess.
Yes, yes. So I did it the other way around.
just to make it hard. Did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy that more traditional approach?
I did. I think I learned a huge amount, and I think it did ultimately also prepare me for a profession in curating or art history.
And when you leave the Courtauld, are you then fairly confident A, art history is your calling and area, and a curator was your dream sort of role, or was it still quite open-ended at that point?
I think I always had in mind that I would love to work for an institution, and that was the sort of, you know, idea I had in my head. I'm not sure I ever really believed that that would be possible. I mean, I was studying in the early 1990s, and it was a recession, and studying art history, you know, I thought at the time, this is ridiculously optimistic. What are you doing? You're not going to make, you know what, I'm making myself unemployable. What use is art history?
At least you're thinking it. I'm pretty sure my dad actually said that out loud, so don't worry about it.
My parents tried to be encouraging, but I think they didn't really have an idea of where I would eventually land in terms of, you know, employment.
I think also that even like a decade ago, this idea of transferable skills that we're so kind of used to, people jumping across different sectors, different companies, it's so normal now. But I remember when I was studying, it was very much, yeah, but what job do you get at the end of that? And it was just like a constant fear and question that was around you.
Yeah, and I think if you are studying in a context where it is economically uncertain, and I guess my background is economic uncertainty. I had a long experience of economic uncertainty in you know, the family wasn't well off, and that is a constant concern. You need to, you know, put a roof over your head and feed yourself. And those are the sort of basic things. And if you if you're asking yourself whether this can be a means to earn your, daily living, and in that moment in time, it was pretty precarious. And often students support themselves with part-time work, summer jobs. It was incredibly hard to find
Or
anything.
interning for nothing for a long time. I remember that was,
Oh,
again,
yeah.
like 20 years ago. It's all very different now, but it was sort of that expectation that you'd be able to work for free for a certain period of time.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I guess, there's the flip side is if you to a certain extent, if you have nothing to lose, you can also do those things. And once I'd left university, I did work for a short time for a gallery. They paid expenses, but I didn't get it wasn't paid work. But I managed to, scrape together a little bit of money to support myself, and I was living at home. So that was the beginning of the career. And in a way, there was a sort of understanding that you almost had to do unpaid work to begin a career in the arts.
I remember we used to joke about having a diet of potatoes and champagne. So we could only afford to eat like a jack of potato, but then we could go to all the exhibition openings and have champagne. And we'd be like, is this a good diet? I think this is fine. I'm sure things have changed now. I'm hoping people have a more varied diet when they start out.
It's a factor, isn't it? I mean, I think I lived on tins of whatever for literally probably decades,
We're
actually.
really not selling the answer.
No, I mean, you keeps you lean. There's a certain there are certain sacrifices you make, and yeah, you can't you. But I wasn't brought up going out to restaurants. I wasn't brought out up spending lots of money having foreign holidays at all. Always went to on holiday in the UK growing up. It's none of those things were possible in my upbringing anyway. So it wasn't really like I had great. So that's what I'm saying. In a way, if you have nothing to lose, you're not risking as much, are you? Because you don't have anything anyway. So you might as well give it a go. And in a way, that's one of the things I think that shaped my career is a sense of, well, what else am I going to do? This seems, let's see how far I can get doing this. Because there aren't many other prospects.
I think you're being very humble here because I think wasn't quite early on you moved to Tate, didn't you, in your career? It wasn't, you said you did a little bit of a work with another gallery, but you moved to Tate fairly quickly.
Yeah, and I had one paid job in between those two things, which was a very small art consultancy working for a very limited number of clients, and then I went to the Tate. I wasn't very, yeah, you know, I hadn't found my place, and then I applied for a job advertised in the newspaper.
Wow. What was it? Because I know you ended up, you had quite a few roles because you were there between, was it 1997 and 2016? Is that right? Wow. So what was your first role and how was it?
My first role was as a sort of very entry level curator or assistant curator in the collections department,
Okay.
the Tate, which at the time was the only curatorial department, and it was based at Millbank in London because there wasn't another site in London. But that was 97, and yeah, so I really got this very, very entry level job when I was in my mid-20s, 25, and that was the foot in the door in a way. I couldn't believe it. I was shocked, but I knew that this was the sort of thing that I wanted to do. thought that I might spend 2 or 3 years at the Tate, maybe 4 at the most, and then I'd move on and do something, you know, work somewhere else. In the end, yes, you know, I ended up moving within the Tate.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge organisation. As you say, it also opened new venues during the time you were there. So the opportunities there keep expanding, I guess, with an institution like that.
Yeah, so from pretty soon after I joined the Tate, work began on devising what would happen within the new building, Tate Modern. It was a building site. And I was, you know, one of the things I think has characterized my career is being in the right place at the right time in certain respects. And I think I was at the Tate at the right moment in time and then sort of available. There was a group of curators already working on devising the opening displays of Tate Modern, being led by Frances Morrison of Honor Blaswick. They needed more help. And what was offered was myself and another assistant curator from the collections team who was sort of sent as, you know, okay, you can have these two people. And we basically became the sort of gophers, the note takers, walking around, but also, you know, beginning to sort of offer a few observations when we felt brave enough. But understanding that this was quite an extraordinary insight into how to build and a new museum. And, you know, walking around with a small group of senior curators in a building which had no walls or floor or plant and thinking and being, you know, what was being expressed was, if there's a wall there, would such and such a piece fit? And will that look okay, you know, if there's a wall there? Okay, right, we're imagining, you know, using all the kind of art historical knowledge, but also the spatial sense as well, to understand what might go into this building, and wandering around in a hard hat and a high vis vest. And, you know, it's and watching that kind of speculative work go on, which was really an education.
Did it feel like, looking back now, even hearing about it, it makes you not get goosebumps, but it's so exciting. You know, it was a historic, significant moment. Did you get that sense when you were there? Or is it just now when you look back at your career, go, God, that was special?
I think I've always tried to sort of step back and think, gosh, this is an extraordinary place to have found myself, you know, that sort of pinch me aspect of this. You know, I felt very fortunate to have those experiences, and, you know, walking into work each day, into the building, and thinking, this is extraordinary. This is extraordinary. So yeah, I think I had it at the time. And then also thinking, look at who I'm working with and look at who I'm learning from and able to hear from on a daily basis. That's also something that characterized a lot of my career, be it working with truly exceptional people.
And actually, I don't think I realised till you talked through your career quite, like, when we start looking at the chronology, you actually started out with quite a collections focus in terms of your curating experience, whereas I guess I sort of knew you from more of your projects, you know, real start to end exhibitions, whereas it sounds like your foundation was much more around how you present collections. Is that fair? And how does the approach differ?
Yeah, it began by working on the collection, both in terms of acquisitions, but also, yeah, the presentation of the collections in Milbank, but also these, you know, the beginning of Tate Modern, and thinking through how to work with a collection. And of course, the Tate collection is extraordinary, massive, very particular. But I I find collections fascinating. And again, you learn every day that you work on them. With institutional collections, you're working with the sum total of the input of incredible individuals. They're always formed by individuals' collections, sometimes private individuals. But institutionally, you're looking at something that has been assembled through time, through the input of different individuals. And yet, when you add something to it, something changes. And I think, metaphorically, of maybe a bit of a kaleidoscope. As soon as you add something, it shifts everything, and another pattern or set of relationships emerges. So I have this kind of very visual sense of exactly the incremental shifts that happen when you bring something new into that collection, and you change almost everything around it by that introduction. So whilst
Relationships, isn't it?
They seem, the Tate's collection is vast, one can see the ripple effect of bringing new things in. So that was that I find that always changing aspect of collections I find utterly fascinating, and the rethinking of them and the representation of them and the possibilities of rereading them, I think, is also an endless and endlessly fascinating exercise as well.
And you were at the acquisition committee for the Latin American art collection, is that right, for a period?
Yeah, I worked with the Latin American Acquisitions Committee and with the adjunct curator for Latin American art, which was a rotating post. Appointed from someone based in the region who was an acknowledged expert and someone with a particular perspective on the history of Latin American art, who would help shape Tate's engagement with Latin American art in a complex way from the outset. So, by working with these extraordinary specialists from the region, the Tate would then build an expertise. And so I didn't have any expertise in Latin American art before I started to work at the Tate. It was something that was generated through my time at the Tate. And again, being in the right place at the right time, being engaged and interested, and thinking, as soon as I became, exposed to different artists from Latin America and from a wider history of Latin American art, whatever your take on that might be in terms of a sort of framing, I was hooked, and I couldn't believe I was encountering such advanced artists that had not featured at all in my art historical education. So, I think part of being involved in the art world is the constant learning, which is why it's one reason why it's such an amazing sector to be involved in. It's always challenging. It's always you're always adding to the knowledge that you have and always questioning the knowledge you've acquired. But that opportunity to really rethink the kind of art history I'd learnt up until then was also deeply fascinating to me, and I felt also very urgent.
You were there for quite a few years, but you worked with the acquisition committee between 2002 and 2016. So that's quite a long period of time. And if you look at how narratives, as you say, framing and sort of discoveries around Latin American art, that must have shifted quite exponentially during that period.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm doing myself. I mean, I'd been aware of certain things as an undergraduate, like different rereadings of history, and particularly exhibitions and publications produced by Innova. And for Latin America, that was one collection, which was called Beyond the Fantastic, which was a really important book for me. But then also the journal Third Text, and also certain other collections of writings, like a book that Susan Hiller had edited called The Myth of Primitivism, which brought together an extraordinary group of texts and different writers and specialists. Those sorts of things had kind of made a really deep impact on me as an undergraduate. But coming back to this moment of being involved in Latin America in the Tate, from the moment I became involved in 2002, and actually in the late 90s, I had begun to, in a really junior capacity, support working on certain acquisitions of Latin American art that were coming in prior to having a kind of initiative around Latin America at the Tate. The work of artists like Adriana Varejão or Ernesto Neto, artists from Brazil, from elsewhere in Latin America, who had begun to emerge on an international contemporary art stage. From 2002, it was a deliberate very conscious decision to launch a geographical initiative engaging with Latin America at the Tate. And I became involved. The first adjunct curator was Cuauhtémoc Medina. And then there was subsequently Julieta Gonzalez, Jose Roca, Inti Guerrero, these extraordinary specialists in the field. And I became involved, and I kept that role even when I moved within the Tate to different jobs, you know, which I applied for and went through a recruiting process. I changed jobs effectively, but one of the opportunities of working in a structure like the Tate's was that I maintained certain aspects of what I had been doing previously, and the work with Latin America was one of those things. So I carried on with that when I moved to Tate Liverpool in 2004, and I carried it on when I moved back down to London and to be based at Tate Modern in 2007. So
that be a benefit of bigger institutions, isn't it? Because when you look, and it completely makes sense, when you're building a knowledge area and research, it absolutely makes sense to support someone's lineage for spanning several roles.
An incredibly important part of my identity as an art historian as well.
And I hate asking this because it's like asking someone their favourite song or something, but when you look back at more projects, I think, exhibitions, projects, or more start to finish pieces of work you did, is there any that stand out as being particularly significant in terms of your career or your own research?
I guess probably the exhibitions I'm asked about most are, firstly, Afro-Modern, Journeys Through the Black Atlantic.
Yeah.
And which was a big thematic exhibition that I did in 2010. It was realised at Tate Liverpool. I was by then based at Tate Modern, but I had proposed it before I'd moved from Tate Modern. So in many respects, it was a project that was devised for and thought about for Liverpool for very perhaps very obvious reasons of being what Paul Gilroy, who wrote the book The Black Atlantic: Modernity and Double Consciousness, called one of the capitals of the Black Atlantic, Liverpool. So for very real reasons, that exhibition happened in Liverpool. So maybe that's one of the landmark shows that I think about, that I think marks a real staging post in my career. And the big solo exhibition that I made of Mira Shendel at Tate Modern is probably another one I'm most known about for, and which was done in collaboration with the Pinacoteca in São Paulo and a co-curator, Thaisa Pilares. And that was a joy to do. It had an incredibly long gestation. I came to know about Mira Shendel from a close friend, Isabel Whiteleg, who's a great scholar, academic, and who had done her PhD on Mira Shendel in 2001, completed in 2001. And I'd, of course, encountered the work in Brazil, but yeah, that, so it took a number of years to get that project into the program and then to realize it. And I thought it was an incredibly important show to do. And I think the work is extraordinary. And of course it links with where I am now, because we at House of Worth represent Mira Shendel.
Which is a nice sort of circle, isn't it? And then, so you did finally leave Tate. It must have been quite a shift. And you went to Barcelona for 5 years, I think. Macro in Barcelona, where you're chief curator. Was it a big, did it feel like a big jump coming out of Tate after such a long period of time?
Yeah, I mean, it did. If you spend any 20 years anywhere, it's going to be a big.
And also the formative part, like not formative, but quite an early part of your career was there. So it's quite.
Yeah.
Key. I mean,
I in many respects, I grew up as a curator, as an art historian, as an individual at the Tate. I was very young when I began working there, and entering middle-aged when I left. It was hugely significant. And that thing that I mentioned about working with extraordinary people was an extraordinary time for me. The decision to leave was, at the sort of cusp of 20 years. Do I stay? And then I'm effectively going to stay here the entire of my career. Or do I take this opportunity to move somewhere completely different? And see how that can offer different opportunities and challenge me in new ways. And so, I decided to make the leap. And it was quite a significant leap, because it was also, I was changing not just institutions, but cities, nations, complete languages, to work. Climates, absolutely. To work
that has been heartbreaking.
Context, lots more blue skies in
And then from there, obviously, you then come to House and Worth. That is, I wouldn't say a bigger leap, but you're suddenly going from a museum institution route into a quite, I'm not going to say fiercely commercial, but a strong commercial gallery. How did that come about, and how was it?
It came about extremely rapidly in summer of 2021. And
was that in the pandemic?
It was the tail end of the pandemic. And there were like many people during the pandemic, the pandemic had a big impact, and there was a lot of sort of introspection and rethinking, and it was in many respects, yes, a departure from working in a public institution, but in many respects, it was also a return, because I was coming back to London. So it was a mixture of the familiar and the unfamiliar. I'd worked with
or visited or engaged with a number of the artists of the gallery over the years, sometimes in a very significant degree. I'd made an exhibition in 2007 at Tate Liverpool with Ellen Gallagher. Of course, we've mentioned the Mira Shendel show. I'd been involved with acquisitions of artists like Jack Whitten, Glenn Ligon, Lorna Simpson, Frank Bowling. Other artists were in Afro-Modern, Journey Through the Black Atlantic. So it felt, in terms of the roster of the gallery, it felt like a natural fit. Artists that I have huge admiration for in the gallery. Another big commitment that I've had in my career has been to women artists, and I think that has been true for Hauser & Wirth as well, and the possibility of working with the work of artists like Louise Bourgeois or Eva Hesse or Lee Lozano, Alina Sapochnikov, these extraordinary historical figures by now, but also the contemporary female artists that the gallery represents. I mean, many factors made it feel like this was a sort of natural fit. And after 25 years in institutions, I thought, well, this seems like an opportunity to have a different perspective on things. To have a different engagement with the artists and their work and the estates and archives as well. And for me, because my role is curating, in that sense, many things feel very similar.
That's interesting. Because I was going to say, to what extent does it feel kind of like, not that you're separate from the market side of things, but that your role has a different function, if that makes sense.
Exactly. And I think the intelligent idea of the gallery was to bring people like myself in, and subsequently three other curators have been brought in to join the gallery, to ask us to do what we know how to do, which is to curate, to bring that curatorial expertise within the gallery and to explore how that can benefit the artists and estates that we represent. And in that sense, it's a continuation of a kind of professional life as well, you know, and of a way of building expertise too. And I think one of the privileges of being a curator is that working with the art object, working with the archive or the studio or the estate, and that access to the artist and their working environment, even to do studio visits. I think it's one of the most extraordinary things that we are able to do, privileges that we have as curators, is to have that special access, which makes us in a way interlocutors for the artists and their work, to then bring their work to public display or to write about it or to talk about it, and to understand that role in making exhibitions, in creating discursive context or creating texts about the work. That's what facilitates it, but it's also an extraordinary privilege to work with, and I think it's also the thing that fuels us, because, you know, if you visit an artist and you see how they work, then, you know, you come away enthused about it.
And it's always been, to some extent, not a fallacy, but this sort of divide between museum world and market, to some extent, is bit misleading anyhow. As you say, there's a lot of relationships between, it's a, you know, it's a community. There's always interrelationships anyhow, and they don't act distinctly. In terms of like day to day doing your role, though, is in my very naive head, I think, if you're in a commercial gallery, you probably can get ideas moved from idea in my head to up on the walls in a much shorter time frame than if you're working in an institution where I imagine the development time's a lot slower. You have to get more people on board, budgets, etc. Is that fair? Or
to a degree, yes, but not always. Okay. And sometimes you have to work more quickly than you expect to within a museum. Sometimes there are different temporalities. You know, if you're putting together a large scale retrospective or a big thematic exhibition, it can take a lot of planning, especially if you want to tour it to different institutions.
Yeah, sure.
Those things are planned far in advance. But if you're putting up a room in the collection, sometimes it can be, oh, we need to do this, or, you know, so there are different temporalities, and within the gallery there are as well. And there is an, oh, there's a sometimes shorter lead in for some shows and some events, but there's also an ongoing relationship with the artist or the estate that you're working with. And that is a different duration because you are committing to working with them over time, getting to know them in a different way, having an ongoing relationship and not doing a show and then moving on to the next show. You know, so then, you know, in there's a lot of shared experience and a shared knowledge between the museum world and the gallery world. And of course, because I worked for 25 years for collecting institutions, I, you know, you understand the commercial side because you're part of it in that forming of a collection, whether or not you're also trying to, you know, acquire things in the most beneficial way for the institution, but that you understand what's going on. You also have relationships with the gallery world as well, which are on a personal level, friendships, respect for the knowledge of gallerists and what they do and how they work with artists, because ultimately they are representing the artists.
Yeah, that's really true. And in terms, I was going to ask how the actual role of curator has changed over your career, but I think it's quite challenging because you've started in such a massive institution and now you're working with a commercial gallery. It might feel that any changes might be because that change in role, but do you feel like the expectations, the remit of the role of a curator, how has that developed and how do you see it developing going forward, say in the next 10 years?
It has changed, of course. And I mean, I think there's a greater awareness of, at least the word curator is proliferating these days.
True, yeah.
Than it used to. I'm not, there's still a curiosity and a confusion about what that actually really means and what curators actually do on a day-to-day basis. But I think there are different demands, and there are different demands in different senses in terms of what it is that a curator is involved in doing, the core of which is to have a kind of knowledge about the work, to have an understanding of artists and their careers, and to be able to communicate that, make shows, communicate, write, have a kind of scholarly knowledge around the work. But what that means in terms of the narratives that we tell around art, of course, has changed radically. The scope of our understanding of say, what is a story of modernism? How do we diversify that? How we talk about multiple modernisms, the way in which we talk about the terms of a kind of art art historical knowledge around art is completely different from when I began. Even though I was studying at a time where cultural studies, post-colonial studies were already having an impact, I think in terms of the broader art world and art historical map, it's taken decades to have an impact. I guess there's also an increasing professionalization of curatorship, curating courses, but also an understanding that the role of the curator might have to involve fundraising, might have to involve other kinds of activities, relationship with patrons, these sorts of things, which certainly in Britain historically weren't a huge part, but were a bigger part, traditionally speaking, in, say, the United States. So, you know, in Britain, we've become somewhere in between a kind of context where the curator is only thinking about the work and the artists, etc., and this kind of aspects of other roles that have become part of a curatorial remit. I think that is inevitably going to continue.
Definitely in the UK, I would say. But on that note, which sounded quite pessimistic when I said it out loud like that, in terms of advice, we always end these podcasts on, if you were giving someone the advice, maybe just coming out of university or thinking about subjects, and they were really clear they wanted to be a curator or were thinking about it, would you have any career advice at this stage? You're not allowed to say don't do it.
I definitely wouldn't say don't do it. No, I would say I would say go for it, but I would also say stay the course.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I attribute a lot of my career to hard work and generating knowledge and building knowledge and questioning knowledge, but also some of it to chance and good luck. But also some of it to continuing when even that, when it seemed like that might not be the wisest thing to do, or when I felt like giving up, where it felt really challenging and I thought I should just turn my back on this. I think staying the course has been a really significant part of enabling me to have the career that I have, and that sort of doggedness or determination or single-mindedness or whatever you want to call it, I think is a really important thing of like, just don't give up, keep on, carry on, because you will have, you know, low moments, but I think the rewards are always worth working through those challenging moments.
And you've also mentioned a lot of people around you that you found inspirational and obviously working with you on shared goals. So it sounds like you've sort of supported each other to some extent.
Yeah, and I think that's linked to the other thing I would say, which is be open to the opportunities. And I think one can have a career plan, an idea of where you're going to begin, where you're beginning and where you might want to end up. But I think just be open to the opportunities, because I think especially in the area of art, you're always going to be surprised. Things will happen that you will never have predicted. Opportunities will present themselves. And if you, you know, and I think saying yes to those opportunities has been ended in some of the most rewarding experiences that I've had in the arts. And so I think that again, of just being as open as possible, which makes you a better art historian and better curator anyway. But that openness, I think, just without preconceived ideas of because of the pressure of the professionalism, one might think, oh, I need to do such and such and such. I actually just, you know, just look out for those moments where you get offered something that is not on your life plan, but just go for it.
And you've actually inspired me to actually dig out all my art history books, because when you speak, you genuinely sound so passionate about the artist. It reminds me of when I was an undergraduate. And you know what it's like? You start out and you get a bit obsessed with the artists and you read and read, and then life hits you with careers, jobs and deadlines. And sometimes it must be quite nice to be working directly with art and with people whose work you're passionate about every day. It must be great.
Absolutely. I think it's an enormous privilege, and it is so beneficial for one's own self, I think. And I think that's what I want to convey to other people, and that's why I think I often say art is the one thing I'm prepared to be evangelical about. Because, you know, in the world when, you know, there are so many, it offers so much in terms of thinking through the complexities of the lives that we lead and our place within the world and our impact on it and on others. I think the possibility of connection and communication, of empathy that art offers, are profoundly important.
Thank you for listening. You can follow and subscribe to The Bigger Picture wherever you get your podcasts. And to learn more about this episode or to reach out to us directly, please visit us at rcarter.com.